January 4th to 5th. George grabbed the lion off the living room table and threw it into a garbage can outside the house. Would you like to do that to a lion? Only it was a porcelain lion. They made a movie out of this. But you couldn't possibly make a movie out of this unless you understood the biblical doctrine of demons. Now, I've left it for a few weeks, but I began teaching on demonology. I started by reading the book, The Demonologist, about the Catholic lay demonologists, Ed and Lorraine Warren. We then skipped to the Philippines and read the story, not yet completed, of the little girl in Bilibad prison on the front pages of the Manila newspapers day after day, bitten by demons in her cell. Too hot in here. I then read the story of John Wesley's household and their poltergeist experience. We then read sections of the book, The Devil in Connecticut, where Arne Johnson in Connecticut, in compassion for the little boy that was being exorcised, cried out to the demon, "Leave him, come into me," for fear the boy would die in the exorcism experience. Apparently it did. Arne Johnson's defense for a subsequent murder, he didn't do it. And he's in prison in New England today. We got into this after a prelude that brought us in the back door. The strange happenings in and around the Bermuda Triangle. We also just touched at shamanism, if you remember. There's a whole series of books I've brought in here each night on shamanism. The purpose in all that I'm saying is to have a gestalt settle in. If you look around, there's evidence of unseen beings, unseen forces that confirm the biblical description of reality. I spent this afternoon rereading again, among other things, but I quickly went through Reinhold Niebuhr's Lyman Beecher lectures. You refined them through two other lectureships. Published it in the book Faith and History. Dealing with the problem of modern society's inability to come to grips with what's going on in the 20th century. And as he does so adequately, he capsulized history in broad strokes and the philosophy that governed it. The classical views of history, which were but a westernized expression of the Oriental view of history that looks at it as a constantly changing wheel of life. And the ideal was to somehow identify with unchanging reality above it all and escape from it. And the cycles of nature were seen as synonymous with the cycles of history, both of them either cyclical or chaotic and incapable of being ordered. You just escape from it or learn to endure it. stoically. Beginning with Augustine's City of God, and lots of people in the modern world fail to realize the influence that churchmen had on the way man thought and looked at his world. Kings for centuries were under the influence of churchmen. Augustine's purpose was almost identical to the purpose that Paul or whomever he used in the writing of the book of Hebrews was. To tell those Hebrew Christians, as the temple would be crushed and Hebrew worship services destroyed, there was something unchanging and much better to hang on to. And as the Roman Empire began to fall apart, Augustine's voice set the foundation for the centuries that followed, that the church would endure and even rise and be stronger, though the empire would fall, as he talked to the City of God. But Augustine introduced the biblical Christian view of things, that what is really wrong with this world is man himself and his sinning tendency, and introduced again the biblical concept until the Renaissance. The Renaissance destroyed the biblical concept's hold on history by introducing, and out of the Renaissance came the viewpoint of the 18th and 19th centuries, which was commonly shared on all sides of the philosophic and political thinkers of the world, of basic faith in history. Reason takes over. Science expands man's freedom and power, and everything can be analyzed, categorized, understood, and controlled by man. And the Messiah, or Christ, is history itself. We are, as evolution, moving ever forward. Whether it's the communist idea that encompasses crises and catastrophe periodically, but the dialectical process would make the redemption come out of the wreck, and each wreck produces the seeds of the next phase of the spiral that is an improvement over the last, and the rationale for revolutions is thereby offered by the improvement on history that occurs in this spiral. Basically, a faith that history was moving ever forward, and as man expanded his freedom and his power, history could be analyzed, social sciences could be analyzed just like natural sciences, and man could learn to control his destiny, and education, the application of reason, would put man totally in control. And everything was within the domain of man until 1914. By the way, the pyramid marks that date too, when it all blew apart. And man discovered that history was not moving by some inevitable force toward a better life. And our expanding knowledge has put in our hands the frightening ability to destroy ourselves. And the Bible, once again, is to the forefront, as even newsmen who know nothing about it are talking about Armageddon. The biblical answer is the last expression of sin will be the worst, so man isn't going to get better. And whatever Antichrist means, it means the last sinner's the worst one. And the answer to history comes from beyond history, not in history. The Creator must provide the answer and split the heavens and come to clean house on evil and set up his kingdom as Prince of Peace, King of Kings, and Lord of Lords. Now, I'm in the business of proving the Bible right in every dimension. And man has been so wrong in other areas, likewise he's wrong in the area of these supernatural forces. And it's time that somebody coldly, non-emotionally, and without peddling cheap fear, analyze demonology and the evidence is there too. On February 5, 1976, the 10 o'clock news on New York's Channel 5 announced it was doing a series on people who claim to have extrasensory powers. The program cut to reporter Steve Bowman investigating an allegedly haunted house in Amityville, Long Island. I've read this, but I want to just very quickly set the stage and go back to where George grabbed the lion. Bauman said that on November 13, 1974, a large colonial house at 112 Ocean Avenue had been the scene of a mass murder. 24-year-old Ronald DeFeo had taken a high-powered rifle and methodically shot to death his parents, two brothers, and two sisters. DeFeo had subsequently been sentenced to life imprisonment. 2 months ago, the report continued, the house was sold for $80,000 to a couple named George and Kathleen Lutz. They were aware of the killings, not superstitious, and rather delighted that they were getting such a bargain on a house that was worth more, still too cold. And they began legitimately to think that might be why the price was low, but not being superstitious, and moved in. They made a movie of this story, but not a very good movie. You need to read the book. And I'm reading in the context of a broad survey that I've been doing off and on of evidence, a lot of it, for happenings in the invisible world that don't have a natural explanation. Turn it off. Tonight I tell you to turn it on. When I read ghost stories, I want it warm in the house. Now, we've read of poltergeists in John Wesley's house, the devil in Connecticut, the work of the demonologists, Ed and Lorraine Warren from West Point to Connecticut. Now, they were called in on this Amityville horror case. And it was while Ed Warren was writing his report in his office, a little cottage attached to his home, that the attack occurred, which was the opening story I read as I read from the demonologist. Now, we're still trying to get the book. Order while you're young. Craig Lamp is working on the demonologist. But I will say in his defense, Prentice Hall apparently will not print the hardback. And we absolutely cannot even get Berkeley Press in New York. In fact, if any of my New York listeners can find Berkeley Press in New York City and find anybody in, I wish you'd go over there and tell them there's some people in California that want to buy some books. It's the strangest publishing house I've ever heard of. They don't want to sell and they don't want to publish. When we called them first, they had 500 copies. Then we called them second, they said they had plenty. We could have them. We called them third, and they said, no, they made a mistake. They only had 400 copies, and those were sold. We said, well, we'll pay to print 10,000. I believe Craig has talked to two or three different people. And we just get shuffled from phone to phone, room to room. Nobody wants to sell books, I guess. But you mark it down, sometime before the rapture, we'll get it. Because I have faith, even Craig can get it before next September, and I know the rapture, if it occurs in 75, won't occur till September. Oh, 85. Well, nothing like stacking your bets, because, you know, if somebody bet on me, I'd have said it didn't occur in September 75, did it? They bought the house, and immediately strange things started happening. Now, I haven't yet, except brief references of Scripture, indicated an explanation. The reality of a hierarchy of evil, invisible forces capable of manifesting, that the Bible would suggest, not suggest, say, represents fallen angels, a hierarchy of them with various levels of assignment, just like an army, that with Satan fell. cast out of the heavenlies. No, not really. Cast out of their original position in heaven, but still prince of the power of the air. One day to be cast totally out of the heavenlies. We have suggested the possibility that demons just might be those aberrations, bodiless spirits representing the dead offspring of that illicit mating that Genesis 6 refers to when the sons of God mated with the daughters of men. No question but what the Bible suggests, and why I keep saying suggesting, speaks of these unseen demonic forces. I'm merely looking at modern evidence of happenings that cannot have any other explanation except otherworldly, preternatural would be the word Ed and Lorraine would use, Ed and Lorraine Warren, supernatural or demonic beings. After strange happenings, including the moving without explanation of a large porcelain lion that caused George, the husband in this household, to stumble over it one night and hurt himself, and now he's going to throw it out in the garbage can. George, when the happenings began, researched the original ownership of the house, found it was built over a place that the Indians had felt were inhabited by devils. It had a long history in addition to the murder in the DeFeo household. Now it's too hot. We're up to January 4th. They moved in some 20 days earlier, I guess. George grabbed the lion off the living room table. Why is it when I come here some nights that thing can blow? And you hardly hear it. Tonight it sounds like a tornado across the plains of Texas. Doesn't it? Now, is it my imagination or is it loud? What in the world is the matter with that thing? Eerie. George grabbed the lion off the living room table, threw it into a garbage can outside the house. Too many lights in here. Turn one off. Now that's a little better. George grabbed the lion off the living room table and threw it into a garbage can outside the house. It took him quite a while to calm Kathy down because he couldn't possibly explain how the porcelain piece had managed to come back down from the sewing room where they had placed it after its first bit of traveling. She insisted that something in the house had done it and didn't want to spend another minute at 112 Orange Ocean Avenue. George had confided to Kathy that he too felt uneasy about the lion's sudden reappearance. They had moved it up to the sewing room. Here it is. Back down the living room. But he couldn't agree on running away without taking a chance at fighting back. Well, how can you fight what you can't see, Kathy asked. This thing can do anything it wants. No, honey, George said. There's no way you can convince me a lot of this isn't just our imagination. I just don't believe in spooks. No way, no how, no time. Finally, he talked Kathy into going up to bed with a promise that if he couldn't get help by the next day, they would get out of the house for a while. They both were completely drained. Kathy fell asleep out of sheer exhaustion. George dozed off, waking every once in a while to listen groggily for any unnatural noises in the house. He says he had no idea how long he had lain there before he heard the marching music downstairs. His head was keeping time to the drum beats before he realized he was listening to music. Glancing at Kathy to see if she had been awakened, he heard her breathe deeply. She was fast asleep. George ran out of the room into the hall and heard the stomp of marching feet get louder. There must be at least 50 musicians parading around on the first floor, he thought. But the moment he hit the bottom step and turned on the hall light, the sound ceased. George froze on the staircase, his eyes and head swiveling frantically to catch any sign of movement. Can you turn that one on and turn this one off? Or do they have to go together? This is eerie. Is that one on? Is that one on? Is it on? Then leave it alone. It's just plain eerie, that's what it is. Don't like it either. Don't like it at all. I'm boring you. I'm told to go shoring a while. I'm getting out of practice. She was fast asleep. George ran out of the room into the hall, heard the stomp of marching feet get louder. There must be at least 50 musicians parading around on the first floor, he thought. At the moment he hit the bottom step and turned on the hall light, sound ceased. George froze on the staircase. I would too. His eyes and head swiveling frantically to catch any sign of movement. Well, 50 musicians, you know, you ought to see something. There was absolutely no one there. It was as though he'd walked into an echo chamber. After the cacophony of sound, the sudden silence sent chills up his back. Then, George heard heavy breathing, thought someone was right behind him. Spun around, no one was there. He then realized he'd listened to Kathy. From all the way upstairs. Fear of her being alone in the bedroom galvanized George. He raced back up the steps two at a time into his room, turning on the light. There, floating 2 feet above the bed, was Kathy. She was slowly drifting away from him toward the windows. Kathy! Kathy! George yelled, jumping up on the bed to grab his wife. She was as stiff as a board in his hand, but her drifting stopped. George felt a resistance to his pull. Back up the stairs two at a time into his room, never did it again. Turn on the light. That's where he would get you. There, floating 2 feet above the bed, was Kathy. She was slowly drifting away from him toward the windows. I don't believe this. I just don't believe this. Why do I keep reading these things I don't believe? Huh?
Scuzzy!
George yelled, jumping up on the bed to grab his wife. She was stiff as a board in his hands, but her drifting stopped. George felt a resistance to his pull. Then, a sudden release of pressure, and he and Kathy fell heavily off the bed onto the floor. The fall awakened her. When she saw where she was, Kathy was incoherent for a moment. "Where am I?" she cried. "What happened?" George started to help her up. She could hardly stand. "It's nothing," he reassured her. "You were having a dream and fell out of bed, that's all." Let me tell you something. It ain't wise to lie when you're dealing with these people, with these persons. He maybe didn't want to scare his wife, but Kathy was still too dazed to question George any further. She said, "Oh," meekly got back into bed and immediately fell into a deep sleep. George turned out the light in the room but did not return to his wife's side. He sat on a chair beside the window, watching Kathy and looking out into the lightning sky of early morning. Father Mancuso, the priest that had been trying to get to help him, was also watching the new day break from his mother's house in Nassau, where he had gone shortly after the altercation with his pastor. Not because he was afraid of a continued outburst, but it had been impossible to sleep in his stench-filled, incense-smoked apartment. He'd had a fight with his pastor because that terrible smell of excrement was only in his apartment at the little monastery. And they tried to kill it with incense, got nowhere. And the mixture of the two had driven him out. He now truly believed that he was the target of the demonic phenomenon and thought that the odor would go if he left the rectory for a while. At first, Father Mancuso had misgivings about being in his mother's home because he didn't want to involve her in his problem. Then he began to feel feverish and decided if he was to be sick again, he'd rather be under her care. He hadn't had much sleep and awakened a few minutes before dawn. He felt his palms itching and looked at his hands to examine both sides. He considered talking to his mother as he noticed the blisters on his hand and said he didn't want to worry her. She was already concerned about his illness. He sat up till 7 o'clock. "I'd like to call George Lutz," he thought, "and find out if the mass caused any similar reaction in his house." But he postponed it. 10 in the morning, Kathy was still in a deep sleep. George had become worried about her condition. He decided to call Father Mancuso. He dialed the father's private number, no answer. Called the rectory, was informed that Mancuso, the father, was visiting his mother, and they couldn't give out her number, but would give Father Mancuso the message that George had called. These people are desperately seeking help. Let's go on. They don't have much luck getting Father Mancuso. They waited for him when he was supposed to come one night after they'd set up an appointment. It was almost 11. The father didn't come. And when George realized that Father Mancuso wasn't coming that night, and I skipped over a lot of pages of Father Mancuso having recurring bouts with sickness and itching blisters on his hands and backing out of taking on the demonic force, and the Lutz is helplessly waiting and hoping he'd come and believing he would. This night was another such night, and he didn't. George realized that Father Mancuso wasn't coming that night. Kathy had been drooping in her chair for the past hour, her eyes closing with the warmth of the fire. If Finally, she announced to George she's going to bed. George looked at his wife. Not once had she mentioned getting away from the house. It was as though none of the frightening incidents had ever occurred, and it was just natural for her to want to go to sleep. They went up to their bedroom together. Kathy mumbled she was too sleepy to take a bath or do it in the morning. She was asleep as soon as her head hit the pillow. George sat on the edge of the bed for a while watching Kathy breathe deeply. Then he went out to check on Harry. The dog was asleep again, his food untouched. George was about to reach down and shake the animal when he heard the marching band strike up in his house. He ran back in through the kitchen. The drums and horns were blasting away in the living room. George heard the stomping of many feet as he tore through the hallway. The lights were still on, but he could see there was no one in the house. The very instant he could see into the living room, the music had cut off. George looked about wildly. USOBs. And he didn't know that he couldn't be more accurate. Sons of Belial. Where are you? He screamed. George took in great gulps of air. Then he realized there was something strange about the living room. Every piece of furniture had been moved. The rug had been rolled back. Chairs, couch, and tables had been pushed against the walls as if to make room for a lot of dancers or a marching band. The next story opens with Father Mancuso appealing to the chancellor to try to get them to approve dealing with the problems in the Lutz house, because Catholic regulations required official approval, official exorcists, and an official pattern in the act of exorcism. The end of his appeal to the chancellor, Chancellor Ryan cleared up his throat and looked kindly at the priest. You're not to return to that house. You can call the Lutzes and tell them what we've suggested, namely some parapsychologists and others to look at them. But under no circumstances are you ever to go there again. I thought you said I shouldn't consider a belief in such matters as this, Father Mancuso protested. Yes, I did, said Father Ryan, the chancellor, but you've got yourself so worked up over this affair that at the moment, the best thing you can do is disassociate yourself from the Lutzes and 112 Ocean Avenue. They're on their own now. After breakfast, Kathy dropped the boys off at their new school, then drove over to her mother's house with Missy. George was alone in the house. He'd gone down to the cellar to clear the odor with two fans. But when he came down the stairs, there was no trace of any of the terrible stench that had made him vomit the day before. Remember, I read that. He sniffed but could find nothing, even when he went directly to the secret red room. George pulled the plywood paneling back open, flashed his light about the red walls. Damn, he said, it couldn't have disappeared just like that. There's got to be an air hole down here somewhere. Search as he could find no source of the terrible stench of the day before. January 6th to 7th. Earlier that day, am I boring you? Earlier that day, Kathy had returned from her mother's house in time to pick up Danny and Chris at the new school in Amityville. The whole family ate together at 6:30. After they finished dinner, I'm leaving some places. Gotta go. Gotta go. They went to bed. 2 a.m., George began to yawn, his eyes getting heavy, his body getting stiff from lying in one position. A short while ago, he looked over his shoulder at Kathy. She was still flat on her back, her mouth open, snoring. Suddenly, George had an urge to get up and go to the witch's roof for a beer. In the darkness of the room, George could see Kathy. Wait a minute, let me go on. He knew there were cans of beer in the refrigerator, but he kept thinking they wouldn't slake his thirst. It had to be the witch's brew. It didn't matter if it was 2 in the morning, it was freezing. He turned to wake Kathy and tell her he was going out for a while. In the darkness of the room, George could see Kathy wasn't in bed. He could see she was levitating again, almost a foot above him, drifting away from him. Instinctively, George reached out and suddenly George had the urge to get up and go to the witch's brew for a beer. Now, he knew there were cans of brew in the refrigerator, but he kept thinking they wouldn't slake his thirst. It had to be the witch's brew. Now, that's a bar in his area. He wasn't going to go mix a brew. You missed that, huh? I'll start over again. Suddenly, George had the urge to get up and go to the... I'm reading from the Amityville Horror. A true story by Jay Anson. You need to read the book. The movie ruined it. Suddenly, George had... Turn the lights down. Suddenly, George had the urge to get up and go to the witch's brew for a beer. What I said. He knew there were cans of brew in the refrigerator, but he kept thinking that they wouldn't slake his thirst. It had to be the witch's brew, and it didn't matter that it was 2 a.m. or that it was freezing out. He turned to wake Kathy, tell her he was going out for a while. In the darkness of the room, George could see Kathy wasn't in bed. He could see she was levitating again, almost a foot above him, drifting away from him. How would you like to wake up just pining for a good old cold beer? She was levitating again, almost a foot above him, drifting away from him. That's what started me singing. That's scary. Instinctively, George reached out, grabbed her hair, and yanked. And if they didn't like it, then away the girls would run. Kathy floated back to him. You're not interested in this, are you? In the darkness of the room, George could see Kathy wasn't in bed. He could see that she was levitating again. Answer the phones over King's House 1. Almost a foot above him, drifting away from him. Instinctively, George... You know, I'm going to give this book away at the banquet. So I don't really have to finish, do I? What about us that can't come to the banquet? Everybody can come to the banquet. There is no city in America that you can't find a way to get to the Los Angeles. Plus, we're coming to your city for a banquet. He could see she was levitating again, almost a foot above him, drifting away from him. I don't believe this. What do you read it for? Because it's true. Instinctively, George reached out, grabbed her hair, and yanked. Kathy floated back to him and then fell back onto the bed. She awoke. George turned on the nightstand light next to him and gasped. He was looking at a 90-year-old woman, the hair wild, a shocking white, the face a mass of wrinkles and ugly lines, and saliva dripping from the toothless mouth. George was so revolted he wanted to flee from the room. Kathy's eyes, set deep in the wrinkles, were looking at him questioningly. George shuddered. "It's Kathy," he thought. "This is my wife. What in the hell am I doing?" You want to hear that again? He wanted to go to the Witch's Brew for a beer, local bar. Now, don't let anybody comfort themselves by talking to you in here. No fair. You're scared. Tying up my phone all night. In the darkness of the room, he could see Kathy wasn't in bed. She's levitating. Instinctively, he reached out and grabbed her hair and yanked. She floated back to him, then fell back on the bed and awoke. George turned on the nightstand light next to him and gasped. He was looking at a 90-year-old woman, the hair wild, a shocking white, the face a mass of wrinkles and ugly lines, and saliva dripping from the toothless mouth. Now, if you have not made your reservation for my banquet, you still can. They're answering at King's House 1. They're all alone over there and it's cold and they need some comfort. And if you have made a reservation and you have not had a call back to confirm it, will you call right now so we can confirm it tonight? George turned on the nightstand light next to him and gasped. He was looking at a 90-year-old woman, the hair wild, the shocking white, close that door, it's too light in here. The face, a mass of wrinkles and ugly lines. And saliva dripping from the toothless mouth. George was so revolted he wanted to flee from the room. Wouldn't you? Kathy's eyes set deep in the wrinkles. Were looking at him questioningly. George shuddered. "It's Kathy. It's Kathy," he thought. "This is my wife. What the hell am I doing?" Kathy sensed the fright in her husband's face. "My God, what does he see?" She leaped from the bed and ran into the bathroom, flicking on the light above the mirror. Staring at her own face, she screamed. The ancient crone George had seen was gone.
This is the end of side one. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.